You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Months after the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, we find ourselves at a crossroads. Nations around the world, which spent weeks and months in lockdown, are slowly reopening. Shops, cafes, and restaurants are welcoming customers. Students are returning to schools. And for many of us, the global work-from-home experiment has ended. But this week, the World Health Organization made a very sobering announcement.
Although the situation in Europe is improving, globally it's worsening. More than 100,000 cases have been reported on 9 of the past 10 days. Almost 75% of yesterday's cases come from 10 countries, mostly in the Americas and South Asia. We also see increasing numbers of cases in parts of Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
The coronavirus is still spreading. The death toll continues to rise. But now, more than ever, the world is focused on one subject. How soon can we develop a vaccine? Welcome to the vaccine edition of the Inside China podcast. My name is Kinling Lo. A vaccine is more than a physical barrier against infection. It's a psychological shield for those of us still afraid of engaging in social activities in crowded places, like going to the movies or major sports events. For the past few months, you have no doubt been reading or hearing about the race to develop a vaccine. But the science, economics, and politics of vaccines are much more complicated than a simple race to see who comes first, second, or third. Back in our March episode of Inside China, you would have heard us speak with Josephine Ma about vaccines and the complexity of vaccines.
And the WHO director actually said earlier that they are expecting a vaccine to be ready in 18 months. And for that, 18 months, that's already rocket speed for vaccine development.
We are going to catch up with her again for an update on the worldwide effort to develop a vaccine. In particular, the 6 different vaccine candidates that are under development now in China, as well as the ethical challenges being faced by scientists trying to speed up that testing process.
If you have people who volunteer to be infected, then you need a smaller number of people for the trials than clinical trial 3. And that's why some scientists are advocating that.
And you're going to hear from another one of my colleagues here on the China desk at the South China Morning Post, Simone McCarthy, who has been following a different aspect of the vaccine story. And that is on the growing tensions over who gets the vaccine first.
And this is a huge problem because there's no way that we can have a vaccine that's approved and then immediately have 7.5 billion doses for everyone around the world. And so how those vaccines are manufactured, by whom, and then which countries have access to them is an incredibly complex issue and something that we need to figure out right now.
Before we get started, just like our first coronavirus podcast back in January, a reminder to you, the listener, that this is a developing story. For the latest news on vaccine development and everything related to the coronavirus pandemic, check in to our 24-hour rolling coverage at scmp.com. So Joe, more than 100 vaccine candidates for coronavirus have now been registered with the World Health Organization. But how many should we really be interested in?
We are now looking at 10 candidate vaccines, which is now having clinical evaluation. That means they are having trials on people, on human beings. Of course, there are another 123 candidates which are having trials on animals or in laboratories. But so far, most of the attention is on the 10 frontrunners.
A lot of media coverage seemed to be focusing on the idea of finding that one single vaccine that works. But one of your story talks about the need for actually more than one vaccine.
Actually, a number of top scientists from the US, they wrote a paper not long ago. The authors include Mr. Fauci, who is a top advisor for President Trump. And they actually argue that due to the limited capacity for production for vaccine, you will need more than one candidate in order to meet the needs in the world, because the pandemic is now everywhere and the demand is so big. And even if you successfully develop a candidate, you won't be able to produce that many to meet the demand. That's why they argue that we probably need more than one candidate. And also the production facilities in different countries, like whether they can handle a certain type of production for a certain type of vaccine, that's also a question. That's why scientists are now calling for as much investment support for as many candidates as possible, and hopefully we can have more than one candidate.
So Joe, you've talked to us about the production of these possible vaccines, but I'm guessing a majority of the world's population will actually be needing them. So how are we going to distribute so many vaccines to them?
It's a good question, and that's why so many people are concerned about it, because the majority of the world population will have to be vaccinated if we want to have herd immunity. That means like 60% of the population in different countries will have to have the antibodies against COVID-19. And you can't do that naturally, because a lot of people will die after the infection. And that's why vaccines are necessary. And distribution is a problem. That's why a lot of countries, governments, and also organizations, they are liaising and they are calling for cooperation for that. And WHO is also playing a role in that.
So we have seen some reports about Chinese officials saying that a vaccine could come out in autumn this year. Is that possible?
You're right. They mentioned that a few days ago. And what they were saying was the emergency use of vaccine. And not only the Chinese government is saying that, the US government has been talking about the same thing. So for the emergency use of vaccine, an authorization from the FDA or the health authorities of a certain country is required, that refer to a vaccine candidate which has gone through clinical trial phase 1 and 2, and the safety has been proven, and also it has been proven that it can induce immune response from recipients. So after that, those two phases, the health authorities can consider whether they will issue authorization for emergency use for that vaccine candidate. And that has been done before for other vaccines like Ebola. And usually they will only apply that for a certain group of people, for example, healthcare workers or people working at the borders, for those people who are most likely to be exposed to the virus. That's the emergency use of vaccine. So when you hear politicians or officials talking about, oh, a vaccine is likely available in the next few months, they are very likely referring to the emergency use of vaccine.
Joe, we spoke to you in March when we were still talking about how there was this big race around the world between scientists to first produce a vaccine for the coronavirus. Can you recap a little bit for us? How long does it usually take to develop a vaccine?
When I raised this question to a scientist before, his answer was, oh, it would usually take 10 to 20 years. But because this time is very different, because the virus strain was made available as early as January, and people have the genome sequence and they can start working on it. And also because scientists and also officials, they are well aware of the need to fast track the development of the vaccine, because the previous examples like the SARS vaccine, it has to be stopped because at the time when trials could be conducted, there was no transmission at the time. So people were aware of the need to fast track the vaccine. And that's why they kind of like speed up the process and to try to make the trials, the approval for the trials easier and so on. But still, it would take at least like months or several years. And in February, the director of WHO did say he was expecting a vaccine in 18 months. But as I mentioned in my last interview, that people thought that was a very ideal prediction, that was like rocket speed for development.
So China is certainly one of those first countries to say that they're developing a working vaccine and are already starting trials. Do we have some updates on their effort and the development of their vaccines?
Yeah, just a few days ago, a very famous Chinese scientist, Zhong Nanshan, said that six Chinese vaccines currently undergoing clinical trials. So China is definitely a front runner in vaccine development. And people are now watching closely several candidates now being developed by the Chinese scientists. And several papers have been published on international publications. So one is a vectored vaccine developed by CanSino and also with a Chinese military scientist. That vaccine, they published a paper on Lancet, and they said that vaccine is quite promising because it successfully induced immune response from people. Of course, there are still uncertainties, especially because of the adenovirus type 5 they use. And as I mentioned, there was pre-existing immunity of this virus in human beings, and people are watching if it can effectively induce immune response when it's used on people. So that's the vectored vaccine. And also two inactivated vaccine candidates got data being published on different journals, and they all said the data is quite promising, and they checked the response of the animals being tested, and there was no serious adverse impact on them, and also the antibodies are being produced in the animals being tested. So they all look quite promising, but a lot more trials are required to find out whether to find out the efficacy of these vaccine candidates.
So hang on a minute, Joe. So you just mentioned there are two types of vaccines. One is called the vectored vaccine and the other one an inactivated vaccine. Can you unpack those two words for us? What do they mean?
Sure. The one being developed in China is an adenovirus type 5 vector vaccine. That means they inject the genetic material of SARS-CoV-2 into an adenovirus type 5. So adenovirus type 5 is a very common virus that is causing flu that actually give rise to an uncertainty for this kind of vaccine because it's so common. So many people may have immunity from it already, and that may affect the efficacy of the vaccine. So that's one thing the scientists are looking at. Inactivated vaccine is one of the oldest technology, and it's been in place for many years. Many common vaccines, for example, like polio, hepatitis A, they all use this kind of technology. And it means you kill the entire viral strain and put it in the vaccine and put it in like some stabilizer and to induce immune response from a human body. And most of the Chinese vaccine candidates now undergoing clinical trials, they are using this technology. And in order to have the capacity to manufacture it, China is building more high security, high safety standard facilities, because in order to produce this kind of vaccine, you have to have a lot of like virus, and then you have to kill them in order to produce the vaccine. So that means the safety requirement is very high. And in order to facilitate the manufacturing of the vaccine, China, actually different companies in China are like racing against time to upgrade or to build this kind of facilities.
So talking about testing, one of the stories you've written in the past weeks talks about this concept of human challenge trials.
Take us through that. Why is it so controversial?
It is indeed very controversial. It was first raised by some scientists in the US and in the UK. The argument is, in order to have a vaccine as soon as possible, we need to fast track. For clinical trial phase 3, that is a very important step to test the efficacy of a vaccine. So the way to do it is you recruit a large number of people and you either give them a vaccine candidate and you either give them a placebo, and then they should be living in areas of high transmission. And then after some time, the scientists will see like whether the vaccine candidates can effectively protect those people who have received the real vaccine, the genuine vaccine, from being infected with COVID-19. But in order to have enough data, you have to have a very large group of volunteers to do that. And also the time required for people to see whether they have the chance for getting infected and whether the vaccine candidate can protect them is quite long. So scientists saying, oh, we can't wait for that long. So they are proposing, like, can we use challenge trials? That is something quite common for less severe disease. For example, when people develop influenza vaccine, they actually use challenge trials. So the way to do it is, I actually asked a scientist who have done that for influenza vaccine before. So he said, so after receiving a vaccine candidate, the scientist will drip some liquid containing influenza virus. But the influenza virus used in this kind of trials is usually the attenuated one. That means the weakened form. And then they will see whether the vaccine can effectively protect them.
So you're saying that we have to have someone to volunteer to be infected with coronavirus in order to test whether the vaccine is working?
That's true. And that's why it's so controversial. And there are actually like ethical debate about human challenge trials before. For example, for Zika, some scientists did propose to do that. But the kind of ethical standard agreed by scientists, actually WHO has just issued guidelines on this as well after the debate on this topic. And in order to do it ethically, there should be, number one, a cure for the disease. And also you have to make sure that the chance for people to die from that disease is kind of like close to zero. And of course, you have to make sure there is enough medical care given to volunteers because they volunteer to be infected and they need medical care. And usually they have to be put in like a facility. You have to like make sure they all stay there. So there are like lots of requirements.
Do we have any idea of how many people are needed to be volunteers for this to work?
The idea of human challenge trials is that if you have people who volunteer to be infected, then you need a smaller number of people for the trials than clinical trial 3. And that's why some scientists are advocating that. And there are actually people responding to that call. There is a NGO, a group of people started an online campaign, and people can like register online and say, oh, we are willing to be volunteers. And of course, the people who argue for it, they make the case based on the fact that most of the people who develop severe symptoms are elderly people or people with underlying diseases, as what I mentioned before. And they argue that it's actually not that dangerous for young people to be infected and if they are put under proper medical care. But of course, scientists who argue against this are saying there are young people die from the disease And there are young people suffering from serious illness because of COVID-19. So there are people arguing for it and people arguing against it. And that's why it's such a contentious issue.
So apart from the healthcare aspect to the vaccine, we know that the stock market has also been actively reacting to the development of vaccines. We've seen share prices jumping because of the reports on vaccine tests. Is there much profit motive for companies to develop a vaccine?
Actually, developing a vaccine for infectious disease like this is not something profitable. And that's why we see the number of pharmaceutical investing in vaccine development has been declining rapidly in the past like decade. And before COVID-19, there are actually like 4 big pharmaceutical left actively investing in R&D in vaccine. And it's not something for profit. It's not like something to make big money, because this is supposed to be public good, because it's supposed to be helping people to get through this huge healthcare crisis. In order to have the money to do that, there are actually funding platforms, including foundations by Mr. Bill Gates. They have been like investing huge amounts of money in vaccine development and to prepare companies to manufacture vaccines. And other platforms like Gavi, Wellcome, they are all supporting development and also the distribution of vaccine. So it's something for common good. It's not something for profit. But I remember one of the analysts actually described, like, if you manage to come up with the first COVID-19 vaccine, it's like securing a holy grail. So it's very good for the reputation, very good for the image of a company. I can imagine very good for the stock prices for a company, and very good for the image of a country as well.
So thanks for talking to us, Joe, and I'm sure you'll keep us on top of the news on the vaccine development.
The pandemic will strengthen the state and reinforce nationalism.
And you get this kind of race where we're going to produce a vaccine for us, but not for them kind of
a
situation.
A battle between nations that's being described as vaccine nationalism.
Received a patent from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office for his innovative vaccine design for the corona family of viruses.
Simone, you've been reporting on the politics and economics of a possible vaccine, well, what some people are calling vaccine nationalism. The headline of one of your stories have put it more simply. It states,
life or death question. Who gets the COVID-19 vaccine?
So what did you find in your research?
Really, what I found in my research is that this is an incredibly complex problem. On the one hand, we have who will actually develop this vaccine. And that's something that has been compared to the U.S. Soviet Union space race. Although many countries are pushing back against that and talking about equitable access, universal access to this vaccine. But the reality is that we have countries who are pouring billions of dollars to support development of a future vaccine. And it's very possible that those countries will have a stake in getting access to those first doses. For example, there was a recent example last month. The U.S. invested $1.2 billion in the British company AstraZeneca, which is involved with a specific vaccine candidate. And that was meant to secure 300 million doses for Americans. And so we can see that there's really one issue about just getting to that point of having that vaccine candidate. But then once that vaccine, or as is potentially likely that there will be several candidates which may be approved within several months or even weeks of each other. But once we have those candidates, the next question is really about manufacturing and distribution. And this is a huge problem because there's no way that we can have a vaccine that's approved and then immediately have 7.5 billion doses for everyone around the world. And so how those vaccines are manufactured, by whom, and then which countries have access to them is an incredibly complex issue and something that we need to figure out right now.
So you also wrote about something called a people's vaccine. Is that related to what you talked about just now? And what exactly is a people's vaccine?
That's right. So there's been a movement to really push for equitable, universal, timely access to a COVID-19 vaccine. And one of the things, the People's Vaccine is a term which was recently used in a letter, which was a coalition of more than 150 public figures, including many world leaders. And essentially, the idea is that that vaccine should be available for all people in all countries free of charge. Universal, timely, and equitable access is an idea that's also been put forward in a recent World Health Assembly resolution around COVID-19. It's also been supported by a coalition of European Union leaders who have, in collaboration with the Group of 20, launched a program to help ensure that access. However, we have a lot of tools, which are some of which are built into the World Trade Organization, which may be able to help facilitate this. But how it actually all goes down is something that we've never done before at this scale in the world. We hear the word unprecedented a lot, but this really is an unprecedented challenge. There is some precedent when it comes to HIV. So when it comes to how intellectual property rights intersect all of these issues, it becomes a whole entirely other field of legal study. So I spoke with somebody very interesting who focuses on how international trade agreements affect public health.
Dr. Deborah Gleason, Senior Lecturer in Public Health at La Trobe University, Australia.
Especially the distribution of medicines around the world.
The COVID-19 pandemic has really highlighted some long-standing problems in the global intellectual property regime. So at the moment, we fund the research and development of new medicines and vaccines through the price that we charge for those products. So we allow pharmaceutical companies to recoup their investment in the development of those drugs and vaccines by charging a lot to the consumer and to governments. That's a real problem. It's always been a problem for developing countries. It's now a problem for every country in the context of a pandemic where we need rapid, affordable access around the world if we're going to solve this problem and get back to normal life.
And this is her particular focus of research.
My research area is trade agreements and public health. So I look at things like how trade agreements constrain access to medicines and other medical products like vaccines.
Back in May, the World Health Organization had its special meeting of the World Health Assembly, which is a decision-making body for the WHO. You might remember the big headlines that came from that meeting were about the agreement for an official inquiry in how the WHO managed the coronavirus pandemic. But there was something else as well.
And one of the primary focuses of the resolution that was negotiated at the World Health Assembly was a number of provisions affirming the rights of countries to use the flexibilities contained within the WTO TRIPS agreement to make medicines and vaccines affordable to their populations. It also set up a voluntary mechanism where countries and pharmaceutical companies could pool intellectual property rights to provide access to the knowledge, the data, and the technology for products to fight COVID-19.
Most countries agreed to all the points, with one notable exception.
But the US firstly tried to weaken the terms in that resolution, and then when it wasn't able to weaken them sufficiently to meet its objectives, it actually dissociated itself from those particular provisions. So it hasn't, you know, affirmed countries' rights to use those flexibilities, you know, to issue compulsory licenses to manufacture medicines without the permission of the patent owner. And it hasn't supported a broadly conceived mechanism to provide global access to the technology, data, and intellectual property rights for pharmaceuticals and vaccines.
So what happens if an American company is the first to develop a vaccine then?
That's exactly what I asked Dr. Gleason.
If a US company is the first to come up with a vaccine that's, you know, that's effective in fighting COVID-19, I think that will be very problematic because the US hasn't given any undertakings to make the intellectual property available to other countries or to share the data and knowledge that goes into developing that vaccine, which means that, you know, a company could price the vaccine too high and could control the production of that vaccine in a way that makes it very difficult for other countries to provide rapid access to affordable versions of the vaccine. We've seen this same sort of behaviour from US pharmaceutical companies already.
However, the concerns aren't just about what happens if a vaccine is developed. Many academics like Dr. Gleason say there's historical precedent for what happens when pharmaceutical companies get to dictate how drugs are priced and distributed.
I think the flagship case study is the distribution of medicines for HIV/AIDS back in the 1990s. We had medicines coming onto the market that were priced within reach in developed countries, but were way out of reach in countries, particularly in Africa, where the HIV/AIDS epidemic had really taken hold. And there was a huge outcry against the practices of pharmaceutical companies in terms of pricing those products too high. And there was an affirmation in the form of the Doha Declaration on the TRIPS Agreement and Public Health that countries could use compulsory licenses to provide access to cheaper copies of the drugs. Countries want to use compulsory licenses often find themselves under a lot of pressure from developed countries that house a lot of the big pharmaceutical companies like the US. Like, you know, although they're allowed to use these legal flexibilities under the TRIPS agreement, they get pressured in terms of trade sanctions by these countries if they try to use them.
There are 10 clinical trials for a COVID-19 vaccine happening in the world right now. More than 120 preclinical trials are happening as well. But a vaccine has never been developed on such a short timeline. And humanity has never faced the challenge of issuing vaccines to so many people at once. We are facing the greatest test for the global scientific community in history. As always, keep up to date with the latest developments with the 24-hour coverage from the South China Morning Post at semp.com. My name is Kinling Lo, and as always, wash your hands, keep your distance, and stay safe. Bye for now.